The Laura Murphy Show, episode 35.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Now, you're probably expecting me to do as I always do and say, I'm here with Carlos Lara. How's it going, Carlos? And then he comes in and says, everything's great. I'm not going to do it this time because right now, you guys are going to actually have the Murphy Show, if you will. So here's the deal. Well, before I jump into that, let me just give a quick acknowledgement for those of you in our audience who came out to Birmingham, Alabama. This was on Saturday, February 11th, 2017. Some of you came down to Birmingham to see the IBC seminar that we put on, Carlos and Nelson Nash and David Stearns. And so that was great seeing some of you. Great time had by all. I'm sure everyone can agree. Okay, back now to the main event. What are we doing right now? I wanted to do a series for the Laura Murphy Show on tax reform because that's really hot in the news right now, or at least the news as followed by economics junkies, that the GOP has this major tax overhaul that it actually proposed last summer. And now that, of course, Donald Trump is the president, people are really taking it seriously. It does a lot of stuff, but among its most confusing features is that it's going to have what's called a border adjustment tax, a cash flow tax. And so loosely speaking, what it's going to do is put a stiff tax on imports coming into the United States. And at the same time, it's going to give a tax rebate for any exports leaving the United States. Right. So the net effect of this thing, at least superficially, it seems, is it's going to really penalize imports and subsidize exports. And thus you would think, oh man, isn't that going to have this huge impact on the flow of international trade? And you can see why a lot of people who supported Donald Trump would be seriously considering this thing and thinking, oh, this is a good idea. So what I'm going to try to explain in this podcast episode right now is the right way to think about, at least at a textbook level, the major effects of doing that, the combination of policies, namely putting a big new tariff on imports and at the same time exempting exports from any taxation at all. And just to cut to the punchline, what most economists who are commenting on this have been arguing is that actually it's not going to have a huge effect in the long run on trade, and people don't need to be worried about, oh man, does that mean if I'm shopping at Walmart, all of a sudden everything's going to get 20% more expensive because Walmart relies largely on, quote, cheap imports from China. And so a lot of economists who have commented on this are saying, actually, you don't need to worry about that because largely what's going to happen is just the dollar's going to strengthen, whatever, 20, 25%, and that's going to offset at least the main impact of what at least superficially would seem like it would have a huge impact on international trade. Okay, so that's what I want to walk you through in this podcast. I'm not necessarily endorsing that conclusion, saying, oh, don't worry, this isn't going to affect anybody because the real world's always a lot more complicated than textbook economics demonstrations. But this is a very confusing topic, and I've been reading on it for several weeks now, trying to come up with a way to distill what the professional and academic economists are talking about in the journals where we can understand each other and see, oh, yeah, right, in a simple model, yep, the dollar would just strengthen, that would cancel it out. It's hard to get that across to the average person. And so that's what I'm going to try to do in this episode. Then in the follow-up episode, so what will be episode 36, it's again going to be me going solo. I'm going to tell you guys and ladies the standard economist case for, or the principles of tax reform, put it that way. All right, so that economists who look at the current tax code, they say, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Even if we stipulate for the sake of argument how much revenue, perhaps as a share of GDP if you want, that the government's going to take in, this is a crazy way to do it. there are win-win reforms available that would not hurt the amount of revenue flowing to the government and would let people keep more of their money and stimulate investment and all that kind of good stuff. Right. So again, without me necessarily endorsing every last element of it in episode 36, so part two of this current series, I'm going to just walk you through some of the major elements of a typical economist's case for various types of tax reform. Things like lowering marginal rates and eliminating deductions to broaden the base, that kind of stuff. Or why is it that so many economists think taxing consumption makes more sense than taxing income? All right, so again, to repeat, in this episode, which is 35, and the next episode, episode 36, I'm not personally endorsing every last little thing I say in terms of these are the kind of policies I want to see implemented. I just realize there's a lot of confusion here, and economists often assume the people in the audience know exactly what they mean, and it's clear to me they don't, and this stuff gets really complicated. So I'm just trying to make sure everybody understands the claims being made. Then finally, in part three of this series, so that would be episode 37, I'm going to bring Carlos back. We're going to have a genuine Laura Murphy show again. And then we're going to talk about the, you know, relying on the lessons that I've laid out, the principles I've laid out in terms of how do economists often think about these things. Then we're going to look at the actual details of this GOP plan and talk about the pros and cons. Because Carlos in particular has some personal experience from the so-called Tax Reform Act of 1986, which also was supposed to be great, but among other things, it crashed the real estate sector. Okay, so that's the plan. Strap in your seatbelts. Here we go. So to refresh your memory, in case you've got a very short-term memory, what I'm doing right now is I want you, by the time you stop listening to this episode, of course, some of you may have already stopped, but for those of you who actually listen to the whole thing, by the time you're done with it, I want you to walk away at least vaguely understanding why so many economists, people like Martin Feldstein, if you saw his Wall Street Journal op-ed or you see him on Bloomberg, he's been going around saying, don't worry, this isn't going to hurt Americans. You know, they're not going to have to pay more at the grocery store or anything because the dollar is going to strengthen. So that's going to cancel out the imposition of the tariff and then the giving of the rebate to exports. That's his argument. I want you to understand why somebody like Martin Feldstein would be saying that. So to that end, again, I've been reading stuff on this. Incidentally, just as a bit of trivia, Martin Feldstein and Paul Krugman had a chapter in a book. I think that it came out like in 1990, 1991, something around that time. And it was excellent, explaining the economics of imposing a VAT and what happens if you put in a VAT and substitute for an income tax, things like that. VAT, by the way, is value-added tax. So that's another thing floating around in this debate, which I'm not going to get into too much in this episode. But that's part of the context here, is that Trump and some of his advisors have been arguing that, hey, we're not against trade. We're, you know, U.S. companies are able to go head-to-head against the competition so long as they're not fighting with one hand tied behind their back. And the allegation is that right now the tax treatment is very unfair because U.S. companies are getting hit with an income tax levied from Washington. Whether they sell in the U.S. or in Europe, let's say, U.S. companies have to pay income tax, federal income tax. But European companies, they are primarily paying a VAT, a value-added tax. So like a German firm, if it sells in Germany, pays the VAT, true. But if the German firm exports and tries to sell in a U.S. market, what happens? The German government rebates the VAT as it's leaving the borders, and then the U.S. government doesn't impose an income tax on a German firm. It's not in its jurisdiction. And so it's like the U.S. company selling in the U.S. market has to pay income tax, but the German firm doesn't have to pay anything. And then going the other way, if the U.S. firm tries to sell into the German market, that company still has to pay U.S. federal income tax. And when its goods land in Germany and cross over that border, the German government imposes the VAT, because that's how a VAT works. It, you know, when imports come in, it hits the goods with the VAT. But when exports leave, the company that made them gets a full rebate on the VAT. And so Trump and his advisors were saying, this is crazy. How are U.S. companies supposed to compete? And in particular, we shouldn't be shocked that some U.S. companies that still intend to sell to the U.S. market are outsourcing and moving their operations overseas, for example, and then, you know, setting up the construction facilities elsewhere and then selling back into the U.S. market because it just makes sense to save in terms of taxes. So that's kind of that's part of the context of this whole debate. So when somebody like Martin Feldstein, back to the thing. So Paul Krugman and Martin Feldstein have a classic article that many economists would still refer to say, this is a very good one-stop shop for economists to get up to speed on that kind of an argument, like to look at the different implications of a VAT versus an income tax and how does that affect trade flows. But that article is a mathematical model, right? So if you have a PhD in economics, you can read it. But if you're a layperson, it's really going to be incomprehensible. So I've been looking around, reading other economists, trying to figure out how do I get the Laura Murphy Show listeners and the readers of the Laura Murphy Report, how do I get them up to speed on this stuff? Because there is an important idea here, but it's really tricky. So the single best piece I've seen, and I'm going to take partial credit for it, I don't think he'd mind if I mention this, I encouraged Scott Sumner, who he's a PhD from Chicago, and he blogs at EconLog, if you're familiar with that website. So I encouraged him to write up a piece just summarizing some of these issues. And so he used a great analogy, and I'm going to copy that here. So I'm going to link to his post. The name of his post is How to Think About Taxes, and it ran on February 15th, 2017 at the website EconLog. So I will link to that, of course, at the show notes page for the Laura Murphy Show. Again, this is episode 35 if you want to get it. So I'm going to follow the numbers that Scott used just so if you're reading along with him, my commentary, you know, really, really makes sense. I probably would have picked slightly different numbers for pedagogical purposes if I were doing this myself, but let me just stick to the exact numbers he uses in his example so that I'm elaborating on his post. All right. So where Scott starts with this, and I think it's good. So we're going to not worry about trade because trade gets complicated. It's harder to think about that. So it's easier to first think about something simple like gasoline, right? In the U.S. market, consumers drive up to the pump. They pay a certain amount of money to the owners of the gas station and they get their gasoline. Okay. Suppose originally the equilibrium price is $1 per gallon. So now the question is, what happens if the government comes in and levies a 25-cent per gallon tax on gasoline? And in particular, does it matter if the government levies the tax on the seller? So like saying to the seller, okay, for every gallon of gasoline you sell, you go ahead and charge your customers. We're going to charge them. That's not our business. But then whatever, at the end of the month, we're going to settle up with you. And for every gallon you sold, you send us an additional check for 25 cents. Okay, so that's one way they could do it, which would, you know, be a 25 cent per gallon tax on gasoline. Or what if the government said, we're going to levy the tax on the consumers so that when they go to the cash register and they go to pay, they still pay the store whatever it is that the official sticker price said based on, you know, how much gas they bought. But then on top of that is a separate thing. However many gallons the consumer buys, they have to then take that times 25 cents and then the store is going to collect that from them separately and then mail that in also to the government, right? So the store is going to collect it, but like the tax is officially levied on the consumer, okay? So they can, of course, roll it all into one transaction where you just look at your receipt and you see the base price and then the tax. But the point is, those are formally different things. Legally speaking, whether the tax is officially being levied on the seller, the owner of the gas station, or whether it's being levied on the consumer, the person buying the gas. So this is a standard topic we cover in Principles of Micro because it's a neat little result to show that it doesn't matter whether the government levies the tax on the producer or the consumer. There's an important sense in which the outcome is the same in that the distribution of the burden of paying that tax economically has to do with what's called the elasticities of supply and demand, right? So that's a fancy word Don't worry if you don't know what that means right now. But I want to make sure you get the point that the claim is not that we can always say in any given case, oh yeah, it's always going to be the producer or always going to be the consumer. In general, both sides of the transaction are going to bear some of the burden of the tax. What we're saying, though, is that distribution of the pain, if you will, is not dependent on which side of the market the tax is legally levied upon. So let's walk through a hypothetical example, namely the one Scott gives, to see how that argument works. And of course, where we're going with this is once you get the idea under your belt when it comes to something fairly easy like the government taxing gasoline in the U.S., then we're going to apply that same logic to international trade. Okay, so suppose case one, the government levies the tax on producers. So again, the government's saying any producer who wants to sell gasoline, right now it costs a dollar, but for every gallon you sell, you got to send us an extra 25 cents. What's going to happen? Well, that's going to make it less desirable for producers to sell gasoline, right? You're taxing that activity now. So if you're doing a supply and demand curve analysis, the way you would do it is the supply curve shifts to the left, right? There's a restriction in supply. For any given sticker price of gasoline, now the producer doesn't want to sell as many gallons because with the revenue the person's getting, the producer's getting the seller, now they got to send 25 cents to the government effectively. So they're only getting to keep whatever their sticker price is, less 25 cents on net. So because of that, that makes them less willing to sell. And so if you draw the supply and demand curves correctly, it looks graphically as if you're shifting the thing up by 25 cents, the supply curve. Okay. So, and if you go to Scott's blog, like he's got a nice diagram showing exactly this, if you can't picture what I'm talking about, but if you don't feel like doing that, let me just say logically what's happening. Again, if you're a seller and now they're taxing the activity and saying for every unit you sell, you got to send us 25 cents, that makes you less willing to do that. Or going the other way, you would have to make more in terms of the sticker price to keep you from restricting your output too much. So what ends up happening in this particular example, Scott has assumed that the sellers of gasoline are what's called, they have a much more elastic supply than the consumers, than the demanders, meaning it's easier for the sellers of gasoline to pull back output and to put, you know, move the resources elsewhere that didn't just get hit with this tax, whereas it's hard for consumers to drastically cut back their purchases of gasoline, right? You still got to drive to work kind of deal. All right, so that's the idea. And so Scott just picked numbers out of the air, but he said, suppose what happens in practice is that when the government levies this 25 cent tax per gallon on the producer, in the new equilibrium, when the dust settles, because the supply has been restricted, you know, what happens when the supply gets restricted? The price goes up. Everybody knows that. And so suppose what ends up happening is that the new sticker price, which was originally a dollar, now ends up being $1.24. And so now in this new equilibrium, the government says for every gallon you sell, you got to send us 25 cents. So the question now is who really bears the burden of this tax? And Scott's arguing that there's an important sense in which of every 25 cents going to the government, there's really a sense in which 24 of those pennies is paid by the consumer and only one penny is paid by the producer, right? Because from the producer's point of view now, for a given gallon of gasoline, he charges the sticker price of $1.24. He gets that from the customer. Then he takes 25 cents and sends it to the government. So on net, the producer is earning 99 cents per gallon, whereas before the tax, he was earning a dollar. So that's the sense in which he's only really down one penny. The consumer, who officially, legally speaking, isn't being taxed at all, now sees that in the new equilibrium, when the dust settles, if he wants to buy a gallon of gasoline, he has to take his wallet out and shell out $1.24 for it, whereas before he only had to pay a dollar. So that's the sense in which, economically speaking, the consumer's really the one shouldering most of the burden of this new tax, namely 24 cents out of the 25. Okay? So I want to be clear. I don't want you to get confused. The claim is not that in general, when the government levies a tax on something, the consumer ends up paying the lion's share of it. That's not what the claim is. We picked those particular numbers for the gasoline market because that's one where economists think the demand side is very what's called inelastic, that it's hard for the consumers of gasoline to shift away into substitutes. Another example would be like cigarettes. If the government levies big taxes on cigarettes, that's mostly going to just increase the price the consumers pay out of pocket. You know, even if it's technically the seller who has to pay the tax formally, it's the consumers who are going to have to pay the most because, you know, if you're addicted to smoking, you really can't quit very easily, that kind of thing. Okay, let me just finish the train of argument. Suppose the government then were to levy the gasoline tax formally on the consumer. What would happen? So now consumers say, oh, when we go to buy gasoline, remember, we're back to the original equilibrium. There's no tax. There's $1 per gallon is how much the gasoline costs. Now the government comes along and says, we're going to tax consumers 25 cents per gallon. What happens? Well, if you're doing supply and demand curves, you'd say, okay, now it's less attractive to buy gasoline than it was before. Because in addition to all the benefits you used to get by buying gas, now you have to pay 25 cents to the government every time you do it. Buy a gallon of it. So that makes it less attractive. So the demand falls. If you're doing it in terms of graphical analysis, you would shift the demand curve to the left. So the demand falls. What does that mean? Well, the price falls, right? In general, if demand goes down, the price goes down. Okay. But given the way these curves are drawn, given our assumption that demand is fairly inelastic, the price actually doesn't fall very much. So with these numbers, to be consistent, we would say the price, the sticker price, would actually only fall by one penny. So originally, the gallon of gasoline costs $1. If you tax the consumers, the sticker price falls to 99 cents. And so now you say, okay, who ends up bearing the brunt of this tax? It's the same outcome as before. That the consumer officially has to send 25 cents into the government, but that's partially offset by the fact that now gasoline is a penny cheaper than it used to be. So really, on net, the consumer is only paying 24 cents more. And the producer, in this scenario, case two, which we've been covering, where the producer technically isn't taxed at all, he doesn't get off scot-free because he used to be able to sell gasoline for $1 a gallon. And now, because the demand has been reduced, he sees the new equilibrium sticker price is 99 cents. So he's losing a penny for every gallon that he sells compared to the no tax baseline. And so that's the important economic sense in which the producer is still paying a penny per gallon of this new tax, even though technically he's not being taxed at all. Okay, so to recap, and again, this is literally textbook principles level stuff. The idea is that for any given market, if the government levies a tax, it's immaterial whether the tax is formally levied on the producer or the consumer. What happens is prices adjust one way or the other so that in practice, when you take into account the price movement, the burden of that tax falls on the parties in a certain proportion that has to do with how easy it is for the parties to get away from that market, to substitute into something else. And what ends up happening is the party that really can't get away very easily, that they really want to either sell that product or use that product, they're the ones that end up eating most of the cost of the tax, if you will. Okay, so again, with these particular numbers, we just picked those out of the air. But the important thing is the numbers work out such that the burden of the tax is the same, whether it's formally levied on the producer or the consumer. Okay, now don't worry. The rest of this is going to go more quickly, but I wanted to walk through that slowly to make sure you got it. So now, what happens? Forget taxes. What happens if you did a subsidy? What if the government, for some reason, wanted to encourage people to buy and sell gasoline? And they said, you know, we're going to subsidize the gasoline market. Right now, there's no taxes, no subsidies. It's $1 a gallon. We're going to come in and we're going to pay 25 cents per gallon to encourage this activity. And again, we can have two cases. Case number one, the government pays the subsidy directly to the producer, right? The people who sell gasoline. Well, in that case, what's going to happen? because the producer really likes to sell gasoline now, the supply curve is going to shift. And now you have to do, it's like the mirror image, right? Because the supply curve didn't shift or shifted a lot when the tax was imposed, now it's going to be the flip. It's going to move, the supply curve is going to shift a lot to the right when the subsidy is given. And so what ends up happening is the sticker price drops to 76 cents per gallon. And so let's think through what the logic of what happens there, right? So now the sticker price has dropped to 76 cents a gallon. So the producer is still getting, he's getting a quarter now from the government. So what happens there? Technically, the producer gets 76 cents in revenue from the customer for every gallon sold, and then gets an additional quarter from the government, bringing the total amount up to $1.01. So there's a sense in which even though the producer is formally getting 25 cents for every gallon sold, and the public might have naively thought originally, oh, wow, that's a huge subsidy to the producers. Really, in practice, the producer's only getting one penny of that. The consumer is getting the lion's share of the benefit, not because the consumer is directly getting tax money in the form of the subsidy, but rather because now gasoline is 76 cents a gallon, whereas before it was a dollar a gallon. So the consumer is saving 24 cents per gallon. All right. Now, case two, what if instead of subsidizing the producers directly, the government says, we're going to pay 25 cents a gallon to the consumer? What happens? Well, that makes the demand for gasoline go up. But just like when you tax gasoline, the demand didn't move very much. The flip side's true. When you subsidize purchases, people aren't going to buy that much more, right? Because they already are buying the amount of gasoline they need to get to work, take their kids to soccer practice, and that kind of stuff. So on the margin, it would take really big movements in price to induce large movements in quantity. That's kind of the idea. All right. So here, the demand curve is not going to shift that much. And so maybe when the dust settles, when all is said and done, the new price is really just $1.01. And so when you say, okay, now the consumer is getting an extra 25 cents from the government, there's a sense in which the consumer really is only pocketing 24 cents of that subsidy because prices have risen by a penny. On the other hand, the producer, even though he's officially not getting any of the subsidy in this case, there is a sense in which he's still benefiting, right? Because the increase in demand has made the sticker price rise from a dollar to a dollar and a penny. And so now for every gallon sold, the producer is making one penny more than he was in the free market baseline. And so that's the sense in which the consumer and producer split the benefits of that subsidy, with the consumer getting 24 cents of it and the producer only getting one penny. All right, so that's, you see the logic of how that works either way. Now, Scott says, suppose for some reason the government comes along and taxes 25 cents per gallon and at the same time gives a rebate of 25 cents per gallon. What happens? Well, if the government taxes and subsidizes the same parties, it's clear it's a wash, right? If the government says to the producer, for every gallon of gasoline you sell, you have to send us 25 cents, but at the same time, for every gallon of gasoline you sell, we're going to mail you 25 cents. Well, that's clearly a wash. That doesn't affect anything. It just nets out. And the same thing if the government were to say that to the consumers. It would just totally wash out. It would have no effect. Okay, so that's easy. But what's interesting is, suppose for some reason the government said to the producer, we're going to tax you 25 cents for every gallon of gasoline you sell. And then the government said to the consumer, we're going to subsidize you 25 cents for every gallon of gasoline you sell. What happens there? So don't panic. We already have the principles. We know how to handle this thing. So first of all, consider the tax on the producers. We know that that causes the supply to get restricted, making prices rise to $1.24. We also know that the subsidy to consumers makes the demand increase, making the price rise by a penny. Right. So if in the original case, it just went from a dollar to a dollar one. But now if we're coupling it with the tax being imposed on the supply side, the price goes from $1.24 up to $1.25. Okay. So again, you put those two things together, tax or penalize the sellers, subsidize or reward the buyers, that shifts supply to the left or restricts supply, and it shifts demand to the right or increases demand. And so those two things together make the price go up even more than it did in either of the other two cases where we just did one effect at a time. So now the dust settles. The new equilibrium sticker price is $1.25 a gallon. And we want to say, what was the effect on both parties from this combination of a tax and a subsidy? And you say, well, the supplier, he pays 25 cents out of pocket, or yeah, out of his revenues to the government for every gallon sold. The new sticker price is $1.25. So really, how much burden is that producer suffering? And the answer is zero. The producer is still netting $1 per gallon of gasoline sold. Yes, he's paying 25 cent tax formally, but prices have risen 25 cents to exactly cancel that out. So there's really no effect on how much gasoline the producer is willing to bring to market, because he's still netting $1 per gallon after tax. And so in the original equilibrium, at $1 per gallon, if he was going to sell, let's say, 50,000 gallons per month, now in the new equilibrium, he's still going to sell 50,000 gallons per month because the sticker price has risen to $1.25 and he gets to keep a dollar of it because he's got to send 25 cents to government. Okay? So you haven't affected the producer's behavior at all. From the consumer's point of view, what happened? Well, the consumer is technically getting 25 cents from the government for every gallon purchased, but the sticker price has risen 25 cents. So from the consumer's point of view, it's a wash. And in particular, if before at a dollar a gallon when there was no taxes and no subsidies, the consumer wanted to buy 50,000 gallons, now with the 25 cents subsidy, but prices have risen to $1.25, sticker prices, the consumers are going to buy 50,000 gallons, right? Because the same after subsidy price to them is still the same as it was before. And so they're going to, you know, engage in the same behavior because the incentives on the margin are the same as they were before once you take into account the price change. So the point is, even though you might have thought that combination of a tax and a subsidy on one side of the market and the other would totally screw things up, we picked the numbers and did it appropriately so that it exactly canceled out. But here's the last point I want to make on this. And, you know, Scott mentions this, and so this is the genius of his analogy. Notice what has to happen for that result to hold. It's not that taxing and subsidizing by themselves are harmless. No, in general, you tax something, you're going to get less of it. And in general, you subsidize something, you're going to get less of it. But the point is, if you combine a tax and a subsidy in such a way that they kind of offset each other, so long as prices can move, then that makes the thing have no effect. So in this example, the reasons taxing the gasoline owners or sellers 25 cents per gallon while simultaneously subsidizing the consumers 25 cents a gallon, the reason that didn't have an effect overall is that we assumed the sticker price was flexible. We assumed the sticker price could go from a dollar originally up to $1.25. And if it could do that, then everything cancels out. So that's how that example works. So now let's switch the context to international trade. So here, the essential insight is that ultimately, the way a nation pays for its imports is through its exports. All right, and there's different ways of seeing that. But if you've never thought about it before, think of it like this. This might help, that if a U.S. exporter, let's say wheat farmers, if they want people in Germany to buy their wheat, ultimately the Germans need to get dollars somehow. And so how are they going to do that? Well, ultimately it's only by the Germans exporting stuff to the U.S. in exchange for dollars. So I'm leaving out a lot of components of the story, that there's foreign exchange markets and the dollar has to trade against the euro and so on. Also, it's conceivable Germany could sell exports to some third country and then that country trades with the U.S., right? So there's, things get more complicated. It's not just all a bunch of bilateral trades. But my point is that ultimately, if a country is not importing stuff, then foreigners aren't going to be able to get the currency reserves to buy the country's exports. All right. So armed with that insight now, what Martin Feldstein and a bunch of other economists here are arguing is that when the U.S. government slaps a big new tax on imports, if that's all it were to do, that would restrict trade. And so that would make fewer imports come into the United States. That's true. But it would also restrict exports, right? Because again, a nation's exports are the way it pays for imports. And so if you restrict U.S. imports by making them artificially more expensive, that means foreigners now have lost the ability to buy our stuff. It's related to Say's Law, if you're familiar with that discussion. Okay, so in this podcast, since I've spent so much time walking through the logic of the gasoline tax, I don't want to dwell too long on this. But again, let me just try to say it differently. If, think back to Say's Law and the way that the baker, you know, the baker wants shoes, the baker wants to trade with the cobbler. And, you know, the baker could say, geez, I wish the cobbler had more money because he's not buying my stuff. But ultimately, the way they trade with each other is by bringing more to market through increasing their supply. That ultimately, the way the baker obtains shoes from the cobbler, yeah, money's involved, but really, ultimately, it's by making more loaves of bread. And that's ultimately what you're trading, you know, with money just functioning as a veil, as it were, right? So that's kind of the classical way of thinking about this. There's limitations there, but make sure you at least see that opening step in the argument, that ultimately in an economy, you're exchanging real goods for each other. And money facilitates that, obviously. All right. So by the same token, or at least by analogy, let's say, with international trade, if you want to think of it in terms of aggregates, then the way the United States pays for its imports is through its exports. And likewise, the way some foreign country pays for its imports of U.S. goods to them is by exporting goods to the U.S. So again, if you were to just simply put a big fat tariff around the U.S., making goods coming in artificially more expensive, if that's all you were to do, then that would restrict the amount of imports. That's true. But it would likewise, in terms of a mirror image, hurt the amount of exports. Okay, so notice you probably wouldn't really affect the trade deficit too much, at least not directly. You might by doing that you change the national savings rate, but in terms of just making imports more expensive and saying, aha, now we'll restrict imports and therefore the trade deficit should fall. No, you're ignoring that which is not seen, that by making it harder for foreigners to sell us stuff, now you're making it harder for them to buy our stuff. Okay, so what could you do to fix that? Well, one obvious thing would be to get rid of to subsidize the foreigners, right? To say, hey, if you try to sell us goods in the United States, we're going to put a 20% tax on you. But at the same time, we're going to subsidize you with the exact amount of revenue we raise from you, right? If they were to do that, it would obviously have no effect. It would just be a wash. But what if instead they taxed the foreigners trying to sell goods in the United States and they subsidized U.S. exporters who are trying to sell stuff to the foreigners? And the argument is when the dust settles, it would again be a wash. It's analogous to our situation of taxing the sellers of gasoline while subsidizing their customers. But again, remember what had to happen. The one thing that was the wild card there was prices had to be able to rise. So likewise here, the argument is by making goods entering the U.S. all of a sudden get slapped with this big tax, while at the same time making goods leaving the U.S. get subsidized, that can be a wash, but only if prices adjust. So what you end up having to do is you have to make U.S. goods rise up in price, pre-tax and pre-subsidy price. So it's like the analog there is like the sticker price for gasoline, make the sticker price of goods in the United States. So if you could do that, then goods coming in, they get slapped with the tax and they're now on the same footing as goods in the U.S. as they were before, right? So that tax at the border is not all of a sudden making the foreign goods outrageously expensive because goods in the U.S. are now that much more expensive also. So they trade on the same margin as they did before. So you're not affecting that. And you're not giving an encouragement to exports because, yeah, goods that are really that goods leaving the U.S. now get that subsidy. But because goods in the U.S. are so much more expensive because of the higher sticker price, now the subsidy just brings them back down to put them back on a level footing with foreign goods, or at least, you know, compared to how they were before. So that's the argument. So now last step in it is to say, in reality, markets aren't going to force, you know, putting this tax on the border coupled with an export subsidy, it's not going to mean that all sticker prices in the U.S. are going to go up by 20% or whatever the number is going to be. Rather, the quickest, almost automatic way for that to happen is that the dollar strengthens against other currencies by 20% or whatever the number has to be. And then if you think about it, that automatically does what we just said. If the dollar appreciates, which is the same thing as saying strengthen, then that makes U.S. goods with the same sticker price now much more expensive compared to all foreign goods, because that's how foreigners think. They think in terms of their own currency, and so they look at U.S. prices and then, you know, use the arithmetic and figure, okay, given the current exchange rates, how much are these U.S. goods in my own local currency when I reckon that way? So if the dollar strengthens, boom, that automatically makes everything in the U.S. more expensive in the eyes of foreigners. And by the same token, it hurts, you know, so U.S. exporters now, when they're trying to sell to foreigners, they're going to see all of a sudden a strengthening dollar. Oh, man, how are we supposed to compete? And now that just, you know, because of the subsidy, okay, they can afford to lower the price they want to charge, but that just offsets the fact that the dollar has strengthened. So they're just regaining the ground that they would have lost because of the dollar appreciation. All right, so to recap, we walked you through Scott Sumner's example of a guess, and this is, again, taken from standard textbook stuff, that levying the tax on consumers versus producers doesn't really affect who bears the brunt of it. And we did that piecemeal, first of all, just because it's good to know. That's something we teach in regular principles classes, because you don't want to be bamboozled by politicians saying, oh, don't worry, we're just taxing businesses or whatever, that doesn't matter. But then, because I wanted you to really see the key result of if for some reason they were to tax the seller of gasoline and at the same time subsidize the consumer, that those two things would cancel out. But the crucial element in that is that the sticker price would rise. And then you could see how there's a sense in which it would all be a wash, even though money's flowing around. The government's still collecting tax revenue and still sending rebate checks. But nonetheless, economically speaking, in that textbook simple example, you could see how there's a real sense in which largely it would all be a wash and the same gallons of gasoline would get sold for the same after-tax or after-subsidy price to the consumer and to the producer. So then by the same token, so the argument goes, at least in a simple model, if the U.S. government imposes a big tariff on incoming goods while at the same time subsidizing exports, it should largely be a wash, so long as the effective sticker price of U.S. goods can rise. So one way, you know, if we were on the gold standard or something and the dollar was not allowed to strengthen against other currencies, that the way that rise would have to happen is the actual sticker prices in terms of U.S. dollars in America would have to go up. But in our modern day of floating fiat currencies, that doesn't have to happen. The actual sticker prices that Americans see walking around don't need to move much, what can happen is the dollar trading against other currencies can strengthen. And then that is the adjustment you need. And that can offset everything and just make it all balance out so that, yes, goods from China coming in get hit with a 20% surtax or whatever the number is at the border. But that just offsets the fact that the dollar is 20% stronger. So were it not for that surtax and the dollar strengthens, that would have been a huge impetus to imports. So the actual real price, if you will, of obtaining Chinese sweaters or Chinese TV sets in to stock the shelves in Walmart is largely the same. Because, yeah, they're 20% more, but on the other hand, the dollar all of a sudden is 20% stronger. So it can buy 20% more than it could before. So those two things exactly cancel out. And then by the same token, yeah, exporters or wheat farmers might have thought, oh, wow, we're getting, you know, tax, we're getting tax exemption from Washington. So now we really want to sell to foreigners because if we sell in the U.S. market, we got to pay taxes. But if we sell to foreigners, we get a rebate check from the government. So, oh, yeah, let's go ahead and this is awesome. Let's sell everything to foreigners. Forget the U.S. Oh, wait a minute. The dollar just strengthened 20% or whatever. So now our stuff is a lot more expensive to foreigners. And so, you know, we'll have to lower the price that we charge them to get them to keep buying it. So even though we get subsidies from the government, that just now makes us even. We're indifferent to whether we sell to a U.S. market and pay taxes or whether we sell abroad, don't pay tax, but we have to lower our asking price to remain competitive on the world market because now all of a sudden our wheat went up 20% in foreigners' eyes. All right, so that's the argument. We will come back. So again, in the next episode, episode 36, I will explain some of the principles of the standard economist case for tax reform. Again, not endorsing every last jot and tittle of it, but just to make sure you understand how to parse these arguments. And then finally, in the next episode, which will be episode 37, Carlos is going to come back and then we will discuss the actual real world GOP proposal and we'll mention some of the pitfalls in applying these sort of textbook arguments to real world politics. Thanks, everyone. I hope you learned from this episode and remember to check us out. We have much more information and commentary at the website, laramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com. Thanks for listening.
You've just finished another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.